Public Broadcasting.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And I am so excited. My colleague Arlene Engelhardt is under the weather, so she is not going to be in here today. But we have all kinds of guests. And I am really excited that right off the bat, there is a fabulous play that's happening right now in the Tampa Bay area. And I'm not at all surprised that Carla Hartley, who is in the studio with us, is the one directing it. And it's at the Stageworks Theater, The Time of the Butterflies. But and also with us is Isabella Natera. She is the young Didi in the play, one of the Mirabal sisters in the Dominican Republic, the Butterflies. But I was just listening to the news, and, you know, it's great. If they just let that baby vote, there'll be some sense.
Exactly.
Things are changing, but way too slowly. But anyway, and also I want to send out a real congratulations, speaking of women, and at the Stageworks Theater, Carla will be telling us more about their plays this year, The Year of the Woman.
Yes.
But the tragedy of that horrible Southwest Airlines crash, but the engine blowing out, I hope you notice that the pilot, who everybody congratulated for doing just one amazing job bringing that plane down safely, was Tammy Jo Schultz, and she was one of the first fighter pilots, woman fighter pilots, in the U.S. Navy. She wanted to go to the U.S. Air Force, but they didn't allow women to be pilots. So luckily, she went to the Navy, and she said she thought that the experience she had got in the Navy, landing so many fighter jets on the carrier, gave her the abilities to bring that plane down safely. And so it is the time in the year of the woman, Carla Hartley.
Yes. This entire season for us, from October to what will finish in June, has been the year of the woman. You know, I planned the season well before the season was announced in the spring of 2016. So I think a lot of people thought that we're going to have a female president this year. So I sort of planned a season in celebration of that and in celebration of us. And turns out it's a season of protest rather than celebration, but that's okay. So all of this year we've done work by or about women or women's issues, and we're pleased to do. We wanted to make sure that we included woman as activist in this season, and this seemed like a natural way to do it while starting an initiative that I've been anxious to do for quite some time, which is to begin some Spanish language programming, because that community, a Spanish speaking community, is growing by leaps and bounds in our communal space, and we need to make sure that we're serving them in ways that in every way that we can. And sometimes you have to bring theater or art to people. You have to bring it to them in a way that they can hear it. And if that's in another language, then that's what we're going to do. So in The Time of the Butterflies is the story of the Mirabal sisters on the Dominican Republic. It's a play written by Caridad Savic, based on a book by Julia Alvarez. And it's about activist sisters in the Dominican Republic who were assassinated. It is a beautiful play. It's about love and family and friendship and power and how do we claim that. Isabel plays young Dede, one of the four sisters, the oldest.
No, Patria.
Yeah, Patria. I keep forgetting.
I'm right
about
after
poor
her.
Patria.
But I'm second go oldest. Back with you because you've covered so much, Carla.
Oh, sorry. Did I say too much?
No. You never say
always
too much.
Do.
Oh, no. But I'm going back.
Step back.
Hey, you know, you said something at the question and answers afterwards Sunday that I thought was very profound.
Oh.
You said, "Well, really, the history of a nation is actually through the arts."
Right.
And I'm thinking of this time, and the great thing about this play is not only is it being performed in English, but on different occasions in Spanish. And what, 20% or is it 30% of Tampa actually, you know, Spanish speaking?
Yeah, I think it's 23%, something like that. But it's growing every year.
But and so this is the first time that actually live theater and such tremendous theater is being performed in Spanish. And so tell me, when you casted this show, Was that part of it?
Yeah, it was part of it. Everybody had to be bilingual. So it was a very difficult, it was hard. I mean, I'm blessed to have known Isabel and Marlene and Jesse and Cornelio and Lauren for a long, 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 long time. So I would be lying if I said I didn't hope and hope that they would do it. And know that they were capable of doing it. So, I mean, we made them auditions just sort of as pro forma. but I always had in mind the ladies that you see on stage and the gentlemen.
So have you wanted to do this play for a while?
Not this particular play, but I knew I wanted to find work that we could do for a Spanish-speaking audience. We talked a lot about whether how to start that, whether it started with teaching, finding a Spanish-speaking theater teacher who would go into communities for us, which that was our sort of first thing, which we didn't actually get off the ground, but because we kind of decided that if we're going to do it, might as well do it and do it big and make a big splash about it. So, and then other things like that can follow, and I think that they will. I forget the question.
Oh, that's all right. I started out by saying, did you cast a cast? Did you find a cast, and was it hard? But
it was a little bit hard.
I'm going to go on from that because, you know, also this is a time when immigrants are really being attacked. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of strange because we're all immigrants except Native Americans. You know, so in a sense, we're all being attacked. But I think it's also a matter of identity, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the really beautiful extra, almost additions, if you might say, in the play is the American young woman. Whose mm-hmm. parents are Dominican, and so she hears the stories, or maybe she doesn't. Maybe she only hears parts and fragments, and that even gets her more interested. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of trying to find her sense of identity at the same time. And I thought there was a very interesting, you know, kind of sidebar with the older Dee Dee, who is the only sister that survives,
right,
with the young American woman. And I thought that's a really integral part of what's happening right now in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that. It's interesting because Jorge Acosta, who actually co-directed the play with me, because I do not speak Spanish.
And we won't hold it against
you. I know, right? I should learn. I totally should. I took French. Sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's interesting. Every person watching a play needs a way to engage in it. And Jorge would say that the play is told by the sort of device of this American woman who may or may not be Julia Alvarez herself, coming to talk to Day Day to write something about the sisters. But I think that this is going to be weird, and I'm sorry, but I think that Anglo people, white people, need a character to latch onto in a play. Mm-hmm. So they can see the story through those eyes. Not all, but some people need an anchor for themselves. And I think it's a great device to sort of bring the white community into the space. And it does talk about how does one connect to an identity that they may have been apart from, whether by distance or spirit, for a long, long time. So part of American Woman's struggle is to connect back to the community, to the Dominican community that she is a part of by birth, but not necessarily by spirit. Does that make sense, Isabel?
It totally does.
Mm-hmm. Now, and Carla and Isabel, and I'm possibly wrong, but as I read it, Julio Alvarez, actually her father, was Dominican and actually was part of the revolution, but had to leave because his life was endangered. And so she heard about the butterflies, and she got more and more fascinated by it, because he was fascinated by them, because they were assassinated only like 3 months before he had to get out. And so then when she was researching it, she found so many stories about them that she didn't know what was true and what was, you know, and so then that's why she wrote it as fiction. But I thought that was fascinating, because there is a certain metaphor I found when watching the play. And I knew just a little bit about the Mirabal sisters, probably because I've always loved the name the butterflies. And I thought it fits, you know, to me, if you're going to have a feminine aspect in the revolution, and so few revolutions talk about the women, the very important women, you know, that are involved and many times are the glue of it. And to me, there was something about the strength, the beauty, and the seeming fragility, but not really, of the butterfly But to me, I don't know. I just, to me, it would captivate my imagination if I were from the Dominican Republic or if this happened in this country. And to me, that was such an important part. I found the Mirabal sisters. If they didn't exist, they would have created them, you know. And so you're the storyteller, so to speak. You as a young Didi, we're seeing you living it. But also, I see you incorporated into the older Didi, who is the only one that survived but tells the stories. Mm-hmm. And do you tell me what you feel about the butterflies, not only as the marvelous women they were, but the metaphor of it.
Yeah, it's funny because I was born in the United States, but my parents are Dominican. So I kind of agree with both sides. Like, I agree with the American woman because I never felt like I was truly Dominican because I was born here, and that was always very obvious when I went to visit. And then with younger Dede, I totally identify with her because it's like coming home, like going when I would visit every 3 years. So The beautiful significance of the butterfly for me is that I kind of feel like I am one, even though technically they would say young Didi was not a butterfly because she did not become part of the revolution, which is the big issue in the play. But I did find that there's so much strength in going back and looking at my past, her past, and looking at that history. And it is universal. I mean, even before I did the show, I knew the story. My mom knew the story. My mom, my dad lived through the era of Trujillo, and they moved to the States as well because of Trujillo. And it's hard to explain, but it's just such a beautiful story, and there is so much strength and fragility. And I think at the very beginning when they put the butterfly in the jar, mm-hmm. and in the Spanish version, Minerva says, it's revolting. It's trying to get out of the jar. And younger Dede says, no, it's dancing. Look at it. It's dancing. So the different views that you can see from the same exact family and the same exact passion that comes from that family.
Well, you know, I have found with this play, you know, because whether we like it or not, President Trump has really focused on immigrants in a way that none of us like to look at it. But I really got thinking about it, and this play really triggered something that actually, you know, as I say, all of us are immigrants, you know, once, mm-hmm. twice, three times removed, et cetera. And so I'm beginning to realize that just like the American woman or that you know, who are you really? Well, I think that, you know, they look upon the United States as such a melting pot, and perhaps we really need to kind of examine really our history and truly our attitudes to immigrants, because I think really one of the values of this country is that the parents and the people do bring part of that culture. Mm-hmm. And that culture, and most of the time, is much older, has far more wisdom and experience than ours. And I think that's why I found now you in person, so to speak, but also the American character. I thought, I don't think we give value to how much that culture helps all of us, you know, in ways. And so
I'm not sure that we give value to much history or culture of any kind. I mean, I take your point, pardon me. But that's what I do love about the play. It really brings forth a culture that that I wasn't familiar with before I ran across the play, and that I should be. I mean, I don't know. I mean, and to speak to the butterflies metaphor, you know, we talked a little bit in rehearsal about the butterfly effect, where you know, at the
right,
the flutter
quantum,
of a wing,
exactly.
Changes lives and changes things. And there are a number of points in the play where if someone had made choice X, none of this happens.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point where Dede makes a choice that prevents her sister from being with a young man to get her out of the country. And if she doesn't make that choice, then Minerva leaves the country. She doesn't suck Maria Teresa into the revolution. And none of this happens. So I'm fascinated by the play in terms of like the alternate universe perspective, you know, of it, which is what, you know, if you don't make that choice, and that's true for all of us, right? If we didn't make the choice to come here today, then something alternate would have happened, and it could have been good, it could have been bad, but The butterflies metaphor in the play, I think, is very, very strong. It's super intriguing to me. I hope it is to other people.
Well, isn't that what really, to me, good theater is about? That really every one of us is going to reach us in a way and we're going to come away.
Right.
I mean,
with something different or the same thing.
This play really did it. And so, Isabel, I'm going to go back to you. And we're again, Isabel Materi is in here and she plays the young Didi. And we have, well, it's the young Didi. We see the sisters interacting, et cetera, and just some great experiences in that courtyard. And I thought you guys were just terrific, really, in the interplay with the young Maddie coming out. She's the fierce one. And Potty. But Minerva, you know, with her fierce intelligence. But also then, Carla mentioned young Leo, and did Dede kind of maybe have a little crush on Leo, too? I mean, in other words, all these human aspects come into play. But I guess I'm familiar, because you would have been familiar with the sisters. What choice, which sister would you like to play, or is a young Dede the one you wanted to play?
Actually, I'll be honest, I kind of thought that Minerva would have been my choice, just because she is so full of fire, and I thought, wow, that would be something to like bring out. But I mean, looking at retrospect, oh my God, Didi, I walked away learning so much about her. She's changed me as a person, just the tough decisions we make every day in life, and to live with those decisions. And you know, it's funny because I found myself defending her a lot in rehearsals, because you find that she was a revolutionary in her own right. She just came to the party, as I say, a little later because of the situations that occurred. But I mean, she's the reason why the Mariposa story is universal. She made sure that voice was heard after she lost her sisters. And I think that at the end of the day, I think Carla and Jorge knew me better than I knew myself.
Well, you know, that it's so important, because for the listeners, actually this play is going right on right now at Stageworks Theater, and it's going to be going on until the 29th. And Carla, before we go further, what times can they see it? And also, how many more Spanish productions do you have?
There are four more of each. Four more performances in English, and four more performances in Spanish. It's Friday night and Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, and Saturday afternoon. So,
we have matinee
Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
The Saturday matinee is in Spanish. On both weekends, on the last two weekends. This upcoming weekend, the Friday evening performance is in Spanish. And the closing weekend, the Saturday evening performance is in Spanish. So it's I know that was confusing because I can't speak. But go to the website, Stageworks Theater, with an RE at the end of it, .org. And all of those performances are plainly listed. And Friday night's selling real well. The Spanish performance on Saturday, on Friday night. So we're excited about it. People have really enjoyed it, and they have been buying tickets, which is helpful.
Well, and back to the Mirabel. And Carla, the set is terrific.
Oh, yeah. Frank Chavez designed that. Eric Hack built it. And Rebecca Lazarus painted it. So we're blessed to have those fine theater professionals in town.
But you cover so many periods in that courtyard, so to speak. And then you've got kind of the contemporary up in that balcony, which looks kind of contemporary, too, in a way. But it's down in the courtyard. And so we meet the young sisters, and we fall in love with them. I thought, oh, don't put the butterfly in a bottle, please. You know, but then we follow them as, you know, we get the bits and glimpses of them becoming aware of what Teresa Helio was doing. And is it Minerva that has the friend in school, Sunita? Mm-hmm. And Sunita says, oh, Teresa Helio, every one of the men in my family are dead because of him. And so she learns the truth about Teresa Helio. And they have a little play, and that gets Minerva already in the attention. And then as we watch the sisters grow up, and then, you know, they're all... And your costumes were outstanding. Mm-hmm. You know, when I looked at those dresses when they had on, I thought, wow, I thought, that's pictures I see of my... But I mean, I and then when they dressed up for that unfortunately infamous formal dance where Rahilo meets Minerva, and he's pretty repugnant in every way. A lot of people in this country know quite a bit about him. Maybe not enough, but then he's got a wife, but he also has girls all over the country, mistresses or just people he takes. And Minerva catches his eye. She becomes, quote, the goddess. And we see this terrible tension. But, you know, I thought one of the most powerful parts of the play is when they get picked up, because it's more and more as Trujillo gets in more trouble, he gets more violent, he gets more oppressive. And so then the sisters, two of them, Mate and Minerva, get put in prison. And apparently at least Mate is tortured. And one of the very most powerful, and Charlie, you've got to get a recording of that, because I looked and I know that music that they sang to each other. It's beautiful. And were you people singing that, or was there a little help? I mean,
well, the first time you hear it, it's just the actors on stage.
Okay.
And that the text was given to us in the script, but the song was composed by Maggie Council Di Pietra, who did a very great job designing sound for the play. She did all of the underscoring, all that stuff was all composed by her. It's the first time you hear it, it's just the actors' voices, which are lovely and on their own. And then the second time around, they get a little bit of sweetening. We wanted to make it feel like every woman in the prison was singing it along with them. So that's the origin of that.
Well, and music is important in that whole play. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the name of the DJ, because he plays all the male roles. It kind of, because as I say, you've got periods of time there that you cover, from them being young until, you know, they're literally assassinated. And I thought you did that with his music, you know, on the side. That, you know, I mean, I don't know much about Dominican Republic music, but to me, I was kind of getting, you know, it gave you kind of a clue where they were.
Yeah, Maggie was very careful about which songs were permitted to be in what part of the play. I would want to use a song here or there, and she would go, no, 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 no. It's not. She even wanted to make the pre-show music. I don't know. She is detail-oriented. But that, combined with the video, like, we tried to make sure that we showed different ages of Trujillo as well, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of talk of making sure that he is there has to be a picture of him in the house. So as the play moved forward, well, we were pretty careful about making sure that we showed an age progression of Trujillo as well, which I think just sort of subconsciously helped people keep track of where we are in time.
And then another dramatic moment. Patio is the oldest daughter, and she's very religious, and it was fascinating to follow her, you might say, religious development,
right.
which I thought was utterly, totally human. And then, you know, and it's so impressive, because these women are married, they get married, and they have children. And we don't know as much about that, but we know that's happening. And yet they are part of the revolution in different areas. But when Patio, actually, she's not radicalized quite as early. I hate to use that word. It sounds bad. But, I mean, she becomes enlightened to what's happening. That when she actually sees Trujillo's forces shooting down in the back a young boy, young kid, that does it. And it's a very powerful moment when she says, no more. I mean, people have to get involved. I have to get involved. And so I thought, wow, we've got the whole gamut here of how people become aware of really difficult situations and how they handle it. And then I thought it was wonderful the way you handled how the sisters, you know, were actually murdered. They tried to make it look, you know, very subtly, but it was very powerful. And so really, it was just, I found it a very powerful play.
Well, thank you.
I think it was really an important play for this time.
Yeah, and Patria's story is really interesting. And we talked about how the four sisters really represent, each represents a aspect of the culture, the religious culture, the sort of motherhood family side of it, the fire of Minerva, and what did we say about Maria Teresa Mate?
Well,
I forget.
She's the heart.
Youth.
The
yeah.
heart, youth,
yeah.
heart,
yeah.
and
yeah.
youth.
Yeah, she's the energy kind.
So, and it's a well-crafted play. It's even better in Spanish.
I'll bet it is.
Yeah.
I don't speak Spanish, but I'd love to see it in
Spanish.
It
was striking. You know, Jorge Acosta handled most of the Spanish rehearsals, because I was, as you can still hear, a little under the weather. But So I hadn't seen it, any of the Spanish stuff, until we got into Tech Week, and I saw it on a Tuesday, and it was really striking how much more at home everybody felt as they were speaking the Spanish words. And would you don't consider it your home language or your native tongue? Did you learn? You learned English first.
I actually learned Spanish first.
Oh, okay.
I did 1 year in Spanish, and it was tough to memorize. But as soon as it's memorized and playing with the other actresses, I was like, "Wow, this is like home." Like it was sort of like stepping in and not even realizing how much it was really home for me.
Well, was it the one who plays Patria, Lauren Valiente?
Oh, Valiente.
Was she the one that said after the talk back afterwards, she says, "I kind of feel that English comes from the head and my Spanish comes from the heart."
That was me, yeah.
Oh, it was you.
Yeah.
You said it.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. And I thought that was so beautifully expressed.
Yeah, it definitely is deeper in the chest for me. I noticed it. And I even think movement-wise, like I think it's an experience, especially if you've seen it in English and you don't speak Spanish. I think it would be an interesting experience for you to go see it in Spanish and just see where everything is placed on our body and how the movements are on stage, because it is a little wordier in Spanish. So there's a lot.
Well, thanks so much. I know how busy you people are with all the performances, and particularly you actors, two languages, and there's a lot of dialogue in that play. You are really working overtime.
Plus the carpool.
But in the time of butterflies, it is an extraordinary play, and I was so glad I saw it, and I really want to thank you for bringing it here.
Thank you.
And I hope the community takes advantage of seeing it, because it is great theater. It's meant to be. And so, again, they can catch it in both Spanish and English, but they'll have to go different times.
Yes.
And probably best being Carla has this crud that's going around to go to the website to get all the dates of it. But you only have the 29th to work it in.
Yeah. It's a lovely play. And are you up against a break, or can I say something more?
No, you just go right ahead.
Back in the day, in the 40s, there was Spanish speaking theater all over the place here. Centro Asturiano was the only Spanish speaking cultural space involved in the circuit that was then the WPA, which eventually became the National Endowment for the Arts. But the WPA came out of the New Deal, and which focused on culture a lot. And Centro Asturiano was the only Spanish speaking cultural space in the entire country that was part of that network. So they did a lot of stuff. We got to lend a round of applause to Spanish Lyric Theater, that's done a lot of musical theater in Spanish, Sonsuelas, that kind of thing. But it hasn't been since probably about 20, 25 years ago that someone has done a play in Spanish. And no one, I don't think, has ever done it in both languages with the same cast at the same time. So we want to get that message out, that we're really trying to engage with the community that has been ignored for far too long, I think, in our cultural mind. So we want to make sure that we know that the Spanish programming is available, and we hope to continue on that path.
Well, well spoken, Carla, and you've given a very strong message. And again, Carla Hartley and Isabel Martea.
Not Tara.
Don't mind me. The young Didi. So thanks so much, and great work. Really appreciate it. So thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You guys take care, and you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, and it is Community Conscious Radio. And I'm looking at the clock, and so I'm going to go right into the next interview, because the young people are really doing it here in this state and in this country. And I hope that you saw that 7 Florida youths are suing the state of Florida and Governor Scott because of what they aren't doing about climate change. And so I was able to catch up with one of the young people, and she is just amazing, Delaney Reynolds. And so let's just give... I don't have that queued up, so I will in just a minute. Let me just put this music on, and then I will bring you Delaney Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
this down because I want to give just a little introduction here to Delaney. And I literally caught Delaney after her math exam, and so we didn't have the very best connection down at University of Miami, but it's eminently understandable. And she had trouble hearing me, but you'll have no trouble hearing what she said. So, without further ado, Delaney Reynolds. Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show Delaney Reynolds, and she is a young environmentalist extraordinaire, and she is one of the seven young Floridians who are suing Governor Scott. I believe it's actually Reynolds versus Florida, this extraordinary lawsuit that's actually charging them of actually not only doing anything about climate change, but actually doing measures that are actually increasing the factors of it. So, Delaney Reynolds, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I mean, you are the most amazing young woman. You're actually a freshman at University of Miami Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences, but you're also a National Geographic winner. You have won just so many awards, I can't even imagine it, but you're an author. You've written 3 books. But actually, I think that's so tied in because you not only live in Miami, but also you've had the great and good fortune to be on No Man Key, where from a very early age that you were exposed to solar and small residents. And so you've kind of seen, you know, the beauty, but also then you saw what was happening. And so I think that was a huge factor. Was that a huge factor in your in kind of shaping your thinking?
Absolutely. As I've been growing up, I like to explain it that my life has always been surrounded by water, and that has played a huge role in my love for nature, for the environment, and especially all things marine. And so growing up between the city of Miami and right on the ocean and in the Florida Keys on No Name Key has inspired me to want to study marine science and pursue the career that I am, as well as work with my environmental work with my nonprofit organization. So yes.
Well, yes, you mentioned your nonprofit organization, Sink or Swim. So then you formed this. And I think the great thing is I haven't seen your children's books, but you love the sea. It is extraordinary. But did you also were seeing what was happening and you realized, you know, and I think that's a great thing about you young people, because I don't know what's wrong with, maybe people want to deny older people climate change and the terrible consequences of it, and that actually Florida, particularly Miami, is ground zero, you know, of losing, you know, losing, so to speak, its ground to live on. But you young people get it, and so you started to do something, and so you go to the Miami City Council meeting, and it's like 3 books. And did you find there was only one line given at all to climate change?
I'm sorry, can you say that again? You're breaking up a little bit again.
Oh, well, you start from an early age because you're seeing what's happening. And so you go actually to a council meeting because you go through the budget for Miami Beach and that county. And you think that you find that of all those 3 books, there is one line to climate change. And you bring attention to this problem.
I'm so sorry, Mary. I cannot understand.
Oh, well, Delaney, just give us your background because we can hear you fine.
Okay.
Tell us about you're going to the council meeting, and then how can you hear this? Got the solar in the city down there, too. Can you hear me say that?
Yes, the Miami-Dade Commission meeting and the solar ordinance in South Miami.
Yes, just tell us about that.
Okay. In 2015, I read the budget for Miami-Dade County, and this is a 3-volume, 1,000-page-long budget, and in it, there was only one sentence about climate change and sea level rise, and it didn't plan to allocate any money towards the problem. And so that made me absolutely furious, because we're already seeing the side effects, including sea level rise. And so I wrote some blogs about what was happening on my website, miamiseerise.com, and a lot of people read them, and they encouraged me to keep fighting. And so I attended one of the commission meetings, and I spoke in front of the entire commission and mayor, and I asked them to allocate more money. I asked them to allocate $1 million. And although they didn't agree to that request, that very same day, they actually did allocate $300,000 and created Miami-Dade County's very first chief resiliency officer. So it's a step forward in the right direction. And later that year, they actually increased the budget to $1.2 million. And the sea level rise budget for this year is $1.7 million. So changes are being made. And that shows that anyone, no matter how old they are, even if they don't have a vote, they can have a voice in their community. And another example of that, of my work with political advocacy through the Sink or Swim Project, would be in the city of South Miami. A couple years ago, I learned about the solar ordinances that were being created in California, including in San Francisco. And upon reading them, I figured that's a great idea for Florida. I mean, we are the Sunshine State. And so I wrote a letter to about a dozen mayors here in South Florida, and I asked them if they would be interested in creating a similar law for their own cities. And the first person to respond was Mayor Stoddard of South Miami, and he said that he would be very interested under one condition. I had to help him write the law, and of course, I have no idea how to write legislature, so he said he would help me. And we worked hours upon hours twisting the codes from the San Francisco ordinances and using them to fit Miami's codes, South Miami's codes. And so a few months later, we had a draft. I presented it to the commission, and three readings later, it passed with a vote of 4-1 in July of 2017 and became law in September of 2017. And so what this solar ordinance requires is that every construction of a new home or any material renovation of an existing home has to install the maximum amount of solar power possible on their roof. So it's another step in the right direction, and it's an example that anyone can follow as long as you are passionate about something. I'm passionate about climate change and making solutions. And so that's what I wrote to the mayors about. And it just shows that anyone in their community can have a voice. At the time that we had that law passed, I wasn't 18. I wasn't able to vote yet. So literally anyone can make a difference in their very own community.
And again, we're talking to Delaney Reynolds, one of the seven of Floridian youths that are suing the state of Florida. And so you also then wrote to Tallahassee and said, what are you doing about climate change? And they said, not much. And so, Delaney, can you walk us through the process of how you got involved with our Children's Trust and the lawsuit?
Absolutely. So I read about our Children's Trust and their national lawsuit where they're suing Trump about 3 years ago. It was actually before Trump became president, when Obama was still president. And I was just so inspired by what they were doing, and especially by what the brave youth plaintiffs were doing to create change and enact laws. And so I emailed them. I did a little digging online, and I emailed our Children's Trust and asked them if they would be interested in creating a similar law here in Florida. And so 3 years later, you know, it takes time to build a great case and a great legal team. And we have definitely built a great case, and I believe we've definitely built a great legal team. And so the case has finally come together, and we just filed it. It's super exciting. We filed it on Monday, and so now we are just waiting for a response from the governor and the state of Florida to see what happens.
And Delaney, I think one of the most impressive things about you, and I strongly suggest listeners go to your website, you will be amazed. We barely scratched the surface of all this, what this young woman does. I'm very impressed that you young people get it. Excuse me, whether it's at Parkland, you know, where they're saying, no, you know, this is not good enough. We can't be armed like this. And why do you think your generation really gets it?
I think that we're already seeing the effects, and we understand the fact that it's going to get worse unless we don't do something. I think that a lot of adults view climate change, or they maybe even see the effects and say, well, it's already happening. There's not much I can do. It's not going to get much worse in my lifetime. But that's not the case for us. It's going to get much worse in our lifetimes. For example, in Miami-Dade County, right now, it floods about 6 times per year. By 2030, by the time that I'm 30 years old, it will flood about 80 times per year. And by 2045, by the time that I'm 45 years old, it will flood 380 times per year. sometimes more than twice each day. And so those are scary statistics. I mean, this is my future. This is my children's future. This is my entire generation's future. And so I think we understand the science. We have learned to understand it, read it, and use it to actually apply it to our lives. And so I think that a lot of adults just kind of pass this issue off as something that they can't really fix anymore. But I think that the younger generation understands that whether it's climate change or any other issue, if we don't fix it now, it's only going to get worse in our lifetime. So we have to stand up and do something about it.
And on this upcoming Earth Day, Delaney, what are you going to be doing?
So I am having an event here at the University of Miami. I'm involved with the environmental branch of our student government, and we will be having a Hug the Lake event, which is something that we have every year. And so there's a giant lake on campus called Lake Osceola, and basically we invite everyone down to learn about the environment, hug the lake, appreciate their local habitats, and just learn as much as they can about the environment and sustainability. So that's what I will be doing this Earth Day.
And obviously, being here at the University of Miami, Rosenstiel, breeding biological sciences or atmospheric, that science is very important to you. You helped organize the March for Science, and I loved it that that one of your mottos, you all were shouting, science, not silence.
Yes, that is very important to me. I think that especially right now with our current administration, whether it's in the state of Florida or nationally, we really need to pay attention to the science and the facts that are being presented by scientists, because they are showing us what our future could look like. And the fact that our political leaders in higher positions aren't paying attention to that and are putting special interests and politics and profits ahead of protecting our natural environment is absolutely unacceptable. And that's partly one of the reasons that I have decided to sue our government.
Well, Delaney Reynolds, we will certainly be following you and your colleagues here in Florida. Was there anything you wanted to say that we didn't cover quickly?
I think we covered it all. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And when we get a better connection, I'd like to talk to you in the future following what's happening.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much. And you do take care.
Thank you. You too.
Uh-huh. She's a remarkable young woman. She really is. And as I said, we have a packed show today because we've got some remarkable women in this community. Not only you heard Carla and the young Day-Day of the play also, and then just now Miss Reynolds down at University of Miami. And you know what's so bad down there that they have actually, University of Miami has had to move some of its buildings up to a different area. And still, they're getting, anytime they have a cane tie, that the students and the professors have rain boots because they have to wade to the car. It's real. Climate change is real. It's happening. And the kids get it. I think we'd better hope that we get it. But with us right now in the studio, I am so happy to welcome, because Mother's Day is coming up right now. And as a special day as it is, there are an awful lot of women in this community that are under abusive situations. And so Eugenia Parlow is going to tell us about Moms for Moms and Two Men in a Truck. So, Eugenia, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about Moms for Moms. What are you doing?
Movers for Moms is a program that Two Men in a Truck Moving Company started 11 years ago to help moms and families that are living in domestic violence centers to collect essential care items. And the things that we take for granted, they don't have. And we're very passionate about it because one of our core values is giving back to the community. Hence, we have the Movers for Moms program. And this year, we're collecting for Alpha House of Tampa Bay and Sunrise of Pasco.
Well, you know, I have seen the Two Men in a Truck going around, and, you know, I don't know what was with me. I thought it was somehow local. I didn't know it was, you know, national. And I was really surprised to find out that women are so involved in the organization, and that actually some of the areas that the women are totally in charge. And so this was Was this one of the reasons that it was kind of a natural to give help here for some women who need it?
Yes, Two Men in a Truck was started by a woman and her two sons. So she is very passionate, and we have several programs that we're very passionate about. In the fall, we have a campaign that's called Movers for Military, mm-hmm. where we help homeless veterans and their families. Hence, Movers for Moms leading up to Mother's Day, because so many of those moms that are in the shelters, they don't have things when they are taken out of the homes. So when we collect these essential care items, soap, shampoo, deodorant, toothpaste, all these items go a long way in helping them to get back on their feet and to help the shelters.
Yeah, we've done a lot of programs on domestic violence and women and how carefully they have to plan to escape. And there can be no indication that this is being planned. And then to work out the children. This is a serious and a really hard undertaking. And so give us an idea of some of the items that you particularly want that is so important in these circumstances.
Okay, some of the items we particularly want, we need cleaning products. We need baby diapers.
Oh, diapers, yes. I mean,
yeah.
I can't believe how much they cost.
Baby diapers, you know, they need towels. They need, like I said, toothpaste, shampoo, lotions, deodorants. They need mops, brooms, clothes baskets. Everything that we take for granted, they can use.
And I know that last year, or a couple of years ago, they got 300,000 items
yes.
nationwide. And
yes.
I think they're hoping for more this year.
Yes, we are.
And now, because there are so many, I was shocked when I saw how many things, and it made sense. Where can they go to find out what items that are needed?
Okay, they can go to our webpage, twomeninatruck.com/movers for moms, or they can contact any Two Men in a Truck moving location to inquire about our Movers for Moms program, because it is nationwide. And we have 22 collection partners here in the greater Tampa Bay area that are collecting items. We have Troy University, we have Alonzo High School, WMNF is also a mm-hmm. collection partner. We have State Farm Insurance down in Brandon. We have Tampa Type Printing Company. We have daycares. There are all types of businesses that are helping us collect. We have Pilot Bank down on Bruce B. Downs. You can also donate any item at any of our Two Men in a Truck locations here in the greater Tampa Bay area.
Well, and I noticed, and this is going to go to Alpha House. And are you going to deliver it on Mother's Day or very close to that day?
What we do is we do everything for our partners. We deliver the boxes to them. We set the boxes up. We get the wish list from the Alpha House and Sunrise of Pasco, and we deliver those to our partners. The week leading up to Mother's Day, Two Men in a Truck, we will go and pick those boxes up, get all of those items together, and we deliver them to the shelters that Friday leading up to Mother's Day. So the moms and families can have those items on Mother's Day.
Well, that, have you been involved in the delivery in the past?
Yes.
Well, that must be a pretty wonderful moment, isn't it, really?
It is very, very humbling, and it just gives you a great feeling to just see how much it helps those families.
Yeah, and I was thinking that one of the pickup places is Alonzo High. And so that's actually a great opportunity for the students, because I imagine some students are actually involved with
yes.
it. And they get to know the seriousness of this problem.
Yes.
And they get to be involved in it. And as you just said, it was very humbling, you just said, because I think personally that the person actually involved like that gets more out of it than actually the person they're giving it to, because you really, you don't often have a chance to bridge humanity, you might say.
Right.
And so tell me, Eugenia, how did you get involved in this?
I got involved with this when I came on board with Two Men in a Truck 7 years ago. Came to work for them as their regional sales and marketing manager. And my manager, Jeff Knowles, said, "Oh, and one other thing, you have Movers for Moms." I said, "Okay." So I got involved and, took the courses on our website on how Movers for Moms work, and just rolled it out. and started meeting community members and rolling out the program and getting the word out about it. And hence, you know, it's growing and we are looking for it to grow more. And as I said, this year we have 22 partners that are out helping us collect these items for those moms and families living in the centers.
And is that more than you've had in the past?
It's more or less because of the two programs that we have. We have some members and partners who like Movers for Military, and then we have some that would prefer Movers for Moms.
And tell me, have you kept up the acquaintances with some of the women you would meet in the shelters?
Absolutely.
And how does this affect them? I mean, does it encourage them that they aren't forgotten about and that actually it takes a village, as Hillary Clinton said? I think it does, to help. How does it affect them?
It affects them. They just don't realize, and they don't realize that so many people in the community really and actually cares about them. It gives them a great feeling to know that there are people that care.
It does come down to that, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I would think it's also so important for the children.
Yes.
And it's sad that we need to do this. I mean, I'm sad that it is such a serious problem, but, you know, I'm thinking of every 9 seconds in this country, a woman is assaulted, you know, and so it happens, and it has been happening, and I think it's a great thing. And I must admit, as I said before, I thought, oh, I just hadn't thought about 2 men in a truck being so involved with women. And that's another great thing, you know, that so much of corporations seemingly is men, you know. And so how have you found the working experience there, really?
The working experience at 2 Men in a Truck has just been absolutely wonderful. I am truly blessed to work for such a great organization that believes in family and giving back to the community.
And do you think part of the reason, because we're in the Me Too time, and we realize an awful lot of corporations aren't run like that, and it's a pretty hostile environment for an awful lot of women. And I know one of the things I said that would help if more women are hired, if more women are in management positions and higher positions, and I think that only makes sense. And do you think that's one of the reasons? Because there are, and as you said, it was founded by a woman and her 2 sons. Do you think that's part of the whole atmosphere of that company?
Yes, it is, because Mary Ellen Sheets is just an amazing woman, and she's very humble, and she believes in giving back to the community. She believes in family. She believes in the core values that we have in helping the community.
And so people right here, we can see the effects, you know, of Me Too, that we wouldn't need a Me Too if there was more involvement like that. And so, Eugenia, we've gone through this pretty quickly. Is there anything we didn't cover that you particularly wanted to cover?
No, the only thing I would like to add is, if you would like to know more about 2 Men in a Truck Movers for Moms program, please go to 2menandatruck.com/movers for moms, or you can always also reach out to us, you know, at any of our locations. I can be reached at 813-788-7388. You can call or just go online.
Okay, and you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater. And a give day at Tampa Bay is May 1st, but you can donate to WMNF right now. Go to givedaytampabay.org and search for WMNF. We're competing to win a prize for the highest number of unique donors. We know you are unique because you care about our station. Thank you. And thank you to all of you to listening. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. Hopefully Arlene will be back next week. She'll get rid of this crud. And just keep listening to WMNF all dull day. And Eugenia, thanks so much. I know your busy schedule for coming in. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you for having me. Thank you.
Okay, let's put this music on again. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio.
Now when the people shout, you